was The Soothing Sounds of Back in Time by Huey Lewis, because that's what we're doing on this podcast. We are going back in time. I'm Kenny McIntosh, and I'm joined by Sondra, and this is episode one of the Retro Raw Rundown. Sondra, you're part of another rundown.
Another rundown. There have been a lot of rundowns here on the history of Inside the Ropes. This one's kind of different, though. It's kind of weird to be watching stuff from 20 years ago when I was a child and was definitely not allowed to watch wrestling or had any interest in watching wrestling because I barely knew what it was at that point in time. This was even before Austin. Well, no, Austin 316 was a thing. I think we thought it was sacrilegious or something. I don't know.
See, I mean, obviously, and if you listen to the rest of the wonderful podcasts from the Inside the Ropes family over at theinsidenetwork.podomatic.com or search for us on iTunes, you've done one of those to listen to this anyway, unless you're listening to this on YouTube, which we will be posting these episodes every week on YouTube, because I think I feel like this is a really unique concept and a fresh one, contrary to what people might think of, like, you're just going to review old Raws. Well, yeah, that's true. But you can listen to the last SmackDown summary that we did on our podcast feed, episode 9 of the SmackDown summary. And at the end of that episode, we kind of explain why we're doing this. But just kind of very briefly, Sondra started watching wrestling when?
In, like, the first wrestling that I remember was sometime mid-2010. But I didn't start properly watching till probably early 2011. So right around the time that, I think it was like leading up to WrestleMania 27-ish is when I start to have formative wrestling memories. So that was sort of like my wrestling toddlerhood or whatever. Like,
so like 5 years. 5 years of wrestling fandom. Yeah. I started watching in 1992. So a bit longer. And what's interesting about these is, so if you're a long-time listener to Inside the Ropes, you know all this. But if you're on YouTube and you've stumbled upon this, The premise of this show and why we thought it would work is that Sondra hates The Undertaker.
I love that. Why has that become such a thing? Why is that my defining characteristic now?
No, but it's great. Like, but the thing is, and before any of you just turn this off in a mad sense of rage, which is
how could
I felt
anyone
the first
hate
time.
The Undertaker? She must be of the devil.
Which is the first thing I thought when she hated The Undertaker. But here's the thing. Go back to early 2011 and imagine that you had never, ever seen The Undertaker before. You had none of the built-up nostalgia that I have, that Robert and David have, that anybody who is a long-time wrestling fan has. The Undertaker of the last 5 years has been built. He has been propped up by nostalgia. That's been his thing. Now, I love him, so I don't care. But for Sondra, it's like there's nothing there for her to grip onto as a character, which has been problematic for Undertaker programs, correct?
Correct, because the stories are terrible, because they don't tell stories.
So
they just go, look, it's The Undertaker, that's totally enough.
Yes, that which is enough for some people who have that built-in nostalgia. However, for some people, it's not. So anyway, this long-standing joke's come into it where Sondra's just like, oh, The Undertaker again, and all this sort of stuff. And
I hear a gong, and I seriously go, oh, for fuck's sake. Like, out loud. I have this, like, Pavlovian response to a gong now where I'm just like, no, go away.
Because then what's happened is Sondra, you know, her nostalgia is Bray Wyatt from NXT, and Bray Wyatt and The Undertaker's relationship did not help Sondra's opinion of The Undertaker. So
nope.
Either time. So basically, I had this idea for a while of like reviewing old stuff or like showing Sondra old stuff, and I didn't know how to do it and how what the best way would be. And then for whatever reason, I just thought, you know what? We should just review Raws from 20 years ago this week. And for me, it's a case of going back and watching it again, because I've obviously watched it before. And then for Sondra, it's a case of actually watching it for the first time. And we're going to watch this every single week. We're going to go through it. We're going to watch it out with the sort of, you know, time frame of 1996. We're going to watch it in 2016. And we're going to go on the journey with these characters. For me, it'll be for the second time. For Sondra, it'll be for the first time. And I think there's going to be some interesting stuff that comes out of that.
Well, one of the things I like about this concept, too, is that like one of the things we've talked about is, you know, people tell me, oh, you need to watch this feud or you need to watch that feud or this will help you not hate The Undertaker. We'll just keep going with that example, right? Well, I've seen a lot of stuff of The Undertaker. I've seen the whole Streak DVD. I've seen a whole bunch of Undertaker matches. Some of them are kind of boring, too. I hate to tell you. But, like...
No, they are. They are.
They are. And going back and watching and cherry-picking little moments in time works for some things. Like, I mean, I feel like I can show people Sasha versus Bayley and it stands up, right? Like, I've seen The Undertaker 100%. Versus Shawn Michaels. It stands up. Like, it's really, really good. I'm not going to pretend that that match is bad, right? Like, that would be ridiculous. So I don't hate The Undertaker to that extent where I'm like, no, everything he does is shite. But going back and cherry-picking moments doesn't give you the arc of a character, and it doesn't give you the context of what's happening around it. When we were talking about women in the Attitude Era, for instance, I just haven't seen enough of it, and I don't feel like I can properly judge things based on moments that are shown. So what I like about this is I'm going to be getting kind of a comprehensive view as we're going along. So I think it's interesting to do it this way because a lot of shows tend to focus on the pay-per-views because that's where the important stuff happens. And I kind of like that we're almost doing the opposite. We're doing like the day-to-day, week-to-week stuff.
Yeah, and I said this to you. I can't remember whether we said this on air or off air, but one of the reasons I wanted this to happen, and it's, you know, because I think the thing that people don't understand, because this is how I would feel if I were you, is like there must be part of you that just goes, listen, motherfuckers, I do not need to justify my being a wrestling fan based on me having watched the Attitude Era. That is
100%. That's not the predication.
Yeah, yeah. It takes a lot to offend you, and you're quite a laid back person, so it can't bother you too much. But for me, the reason I wanted you to watch this stuff is because, like, I want you to see, because I don't think you've had the chance for the most part in your WWE fandom to watch a lot of long-term successful stories told well to play out on the main roster anyway.
Not on the main roster, no. There have been some in NXT that have been really fantastic, but...
Yeah, so like, and I think this is, like, so for example, one of the things that on this particular episode we get the start of is Steve Austin calling out Bret Hart, who is at the time not part of the WWF. He'd left for a sabbatical. So we're going to go, there's all these things happening. You know, we're starting this the night after In Your House Mind Games in 1996. And, you know, Rocky Maivia has not even debuted. The rise of Mick Foley hasn't quite happened yet. Steve Austin's very much on the rise. There's no DX yet. The China hasn't even debuted. There's so much to happen. And I feel like by us going through it week to week, you're going to be able to either A, understand why people go on about it so much and enjoy it, or B, can go, well, I've watched it in full and I just don't like it. You know, and either way, it's going to be better for you as a perspective, I guess, to be able to look at it from that perspective, if that makes sense.
No, it does. And I think it'll be interesting too, revisiting areas of time where people do have so much nostalgia. Like, especially a lot of people in our age group were, you know, kids or, you know, entering adolescence when all of this was going on. So watching it back as an adult, seeing what holds up, what doesn't. I mean, I'm not going into it going, haha, I'm going to prove that now is better than then. I don't know if it is or not. Like, I don't know what I'm going to prefer because I haven't seen it yet. I just think it'll be interesting to go and talk about it, like, kind of as we go. And then to hear, you know, your thoughts on it going back through it from stuff that you remember. Like, is it the way you remember it? Is it not? I think our perspectives are so different, and we're such different types of wrestling fans anyway. Like, not like discounting are. The modern versus past fandoms. Like, you and I just have really different ways that we approach wrestling, which I think just leads to interesting discussions. I think that's something that works well about us doing shows together is we disagree a lot, but it makes for some interesting talk.
It does. It does. And for me, like, even going through this first episode, I remember watching this episode then. So I remember, and I'll talk about some of that during the show. Like, I remember how I felt about certain things. And that'll be interesting. But for me, like, I think that 1997 WWF is their best year they ever had as a full year. And for me, if in a year's time you turn around and go, do you know what, I don't want to do these rundowns anymore, at least you're going to have got to see what I think is their best year.
Yeah.
And make your own judgment about it. Because the thing about this that's really interesting is that this was the height of the WCW wars. You know, WCW by September of 96 were winning every week.
Yeah, it was interesting because there's a sign in the crowd that I noticed and it said, we can't wrestle. And at first I didn't get it. I was like, well, of course you can't wrestle. You're an audience member. Like,
then you noticed the W and the C.
Then I noticed
the
WCW and was like, oh, okay, gotcha.
And there's stuff that's going to become clear as we go into this episode. So the thing for now is, like, so your version of the Monday Night Wars, I guess, is WWE and TNA. And the only time...
No, it's not.
Well, you know, that's the only kind of... I mean, it's not the same thing. But, like, what I mean is, like, the only big alternative, really, in North America that there has been... To WWE is TNA, really. In the last,
but I
years.
Mean, think about it. When was TNA even that popular before I started watching wrestling? I've never
That's
had
true.
This concept.
Well, go with the idea for a second.
Okay.
Because what I was going to say is the only time that I remember, now, if you remember another occasion, please do tweet me and tell me, Kenny MC 1985, Saunders with RW, Inside _ the Ropes. It was... In 2011, during the Summer of Punk, when John Cena was about to face Punk, I think it was when he was about to face Punk at Money in the Bank, and Vince had basically said that if he lost the match, he would be fired. And Cena said in one of his promos, if I can't work here, I'll go somewhere else, brother. And that's the only time that WWE have really referenced TNA on air. That one thing, where they didn't even mention the name, they just did that. But when we're going to go through these shows...
I mean, until recently, I guess, yeah. When they started bringing in
all the
teenagers.
When we go through these shows, it is war. Like, these guys are going to take shots at each other whenever they can. There'll be times where WCW is brought up in a promo or whatever. Like, it was more prevalent than it is now. So that's going to be interesting as well, because I feel like I'm probably going to have to put some context to some of the things that are said, because there might be some things that are said that you don't pick up on. Because why would you, if you didn't watch at the time and knew what was going on in WCW, you might not pick up on a reference. So, like, for example, in this episode, there's a Jeff Jarrett thing that happens.
Oh, I have so many thoughts about this.
So that relates to different things. So we are going to go into it. But before we do, we are going to review the September 23rd, 1996 edition of Monday Night Raw. It is September 23rd, 2016, so 20 years ago today this aired on the USA Network. 20 years ago today, Los Del Rios were number one in the Billboard Hot 100 with Macarena. That's something I'll be telling you every week of what is number one in the charts 20 years ago. So we're in the night after Mind Games in Your House, Hershey, Pennsylvania. Kevin Kelly, Jim Ross, and Jerry the King Lawler on commentary. Before we get into the show, tell me your thoughts on the opening intro video that they have, the set, the look. Tell me your thoughts on all of that.
Okay, my favorite thing about the set is, and I don't know why, I was just so excited about this, and it just makes me laugh, and I giggle every single time people come out on the set, because they're building to Buried Alive, so they have this big, huge gravestone in the middle of the aisle, so you can't just walk out and do an entrance, right? Because you have to walk around this gravestone. Now, it would be a fine, nice kind of obsidian gravestone with the Undertaker and Mankind looking, but then smack dab in the middle of this gravestone that's supposed to look all spooky and creepy and dark and, someone's going to be buried alive. Literally buried alive, as JR says on commentary at one point. He's like, someone's going to be buried alive. Literally. 6 feet under. And I was like, you're gonna do a murder on pay-per-view? Okay, that doesn't sound like a great idea. You'll probably go to jail, but whatever. My favorite thing about this gravestone is that it has the In Your House logo on it in full color, full neon, full 90s-tastic. I mean, that In Your House logo looks so much like the Full House logo to me. And so it just, for some reason, the thought of this like super spooky, creepy gravestone with the like big old neon in your house, like it makes me laugh so hard. And it has like the big R-A-W like that they have to walk through like slatted. I don't know. You pay more attention to sets than I do. Like the opening video package, I didn't really pay that much attention to because it's just never been something that I noticed that much. But that gravestone, man, that's just hilarious. And they have to walk past it every single time. It's in the way. Like, I really wanted someone to walk into it or trip.
Well, because they'd never done anything like that before. You know, this was the first time. So they, so this was their way of... They'd never done a buried alive match before. This was the first one.
Oh.
So I think that was the idea, was that they're just going to put this gravestone in the aisle.
I mean, the spooky factor is just destroyed with that little... In your house. Because I imagine it, like, in your house.
This is true. Yeah,
it's so bright.
It does take away from the spooky factor. Kevin Kelly's on commentary, Jim Ross, Jerry the King Lawler.
I did want to ask about this because, like, when Ross started going to a three-man announce booth in whenever that was recently, like, in my wrestling fandom, everyone was like, the three-man booth is terrible, two-man is better, blah, blah, blah. Because I know for a long time on Raw, it was Jerry the King Lawler and JR, and it was just the two of them. And... like when I listen to old pay-per-view reviews, Kevin Kelly is not on commentary on those either, right? Like, did they have, was this three-man thing common then, or was this, and I mean, let's be honest, most of the show it's a four-man booth because like everybody's on guest commentary.
Yeah, no, Raw and its hosts have a weird history, I guess, because there used to be, so it was always a two-man booth. I'm trying to actually get it up. Right, so here is the history of the Raw announce team, just for clarity. So they started off with a three-man booth with Vince McMahon, Randy Savage, and the comedian Rob Bartlett, who was a guest on Inside the Ropes at one point.
I remember him.
And that was kind of like, I mean, there was some weeks where like Vince wasn't there, so Gorilla would come in or whatever. But for the most part, it was like a three-man booth up until... Randy Savage left. Well, for the last few months of Randy Savage being there, it was Vince and Randy Savage. So then it became a two-man booth for like a couple of years. And then Kevin Kelly turned up about a month before this. And it was him, JR, and King. And they are the commentary team for about another month. And then we get Vince back. And then we get Vince, JR, and Lawler for like a year. And then it become... And then... When it becomes Raw is War, this gets even more complicated. There's like a three-man announce booth for the first hour, but then a two-man announce booth for the second hour.
That's weird.
So like Raw is War, as a TV show, the first hour was called WWF Raw, and the second hour was called WWF Warzone.
This is stuff that we're going to be watching soon?
Yep. This is coming up in about 6 months or so.
Interesting.
But the thing that Kevin Kelly's brought in, and I'm not even too, I mean, I would like to speak to him about it. I'm sure he's spoken about it in other interviews, but it seemed like he was brought in as like, you know, here's the new guy we want to try as a ring announcer, as a commentator. You know, he's a young, attractive-ish guy, whatever. So he's not like, he's not a southern older guy, is essentially what I'm saying. But he's only given like 2 months, and then he's sort of put onto the... He's put onto the backstage announcing and stuff. So,
like, what I know of Kevin Kelly from, you know, again, listening to pay-per-view reviews and whatnot, is that he was a backstage interviewer. So I was surprised to see him in, like, a lead commentary position.
Yeah, so he comes back again at the end of 97 for a three-man booth for the first hour. And then he leaves again. So, okay. But I actually like Kevin Kelly's commentary, to be fair, but...
I thought, you know, it was good. It was fine. It was nothing, you know.
Yeah, he was good. So the opening match of the show is the finals of the Intercontinental Championship tournament with the Wildman Mark Merrill and Farouk. Now, for context, I don't know if you read up on this or not, but what had happened was in August of that year, Ahmed Johnson was the IC champ, and he had like a legit kidney injury.
Okay.
And the way they wrote him off TV was he won an 11-man battle royal, because, you know, that's the best number to have. He won an 11-man battle royal to become number one contender to the WWF championship. So But then after that, Farouk Assad, as he was known originally, debuted by kicking the shit out of Ahmed Johnson, and that was the storyline reason for him being taken out of the picture.
Oh, so is Farouk just recently debuted then?
Yes.
Okay, because they did say on commentary that Farouk took out Ahmed Johnson, because they have Ahmed Johnson call in at one point on the phone to,
yes,
you know, be angry or whatever, and then Lawler says, like, oh, I heard you got a kidney transplant from Jake the Snake Roberts, and then I thought Ahmed Johnson was going to come through the phone and, like, eat Jerry Lawler's face or something.
Yeah, essentially that's you're not far off. Ahmed Johnson on the phone, as, and I can say this with experience, is an awkward experience.
I remember those interviews too.
Jesus. Ahmed Johnson part 1 and 2, each part 2.5 hours.
Oh, they're so mental.
They're so long. So Farouk debuted by any sort of beat up Ahmed Johnson. He was managed by Sonny. Now Sonny's thing was, Sonny had originally came to WWF to manage her boyfriend, Chris Candido, who was Skip. And Sonny and Skip were called the Body Donnas. Then in sort of early 96, they brought in Tom Pritchard to be Zip. So it was Skip and Zip.
The Body Donnas. I have thoughts on them later.
Yep, so we will get to them. Now, Sonny managed them, but then, now I thought this was a great story for Sonny, because Sonny's whole gimmick was she wanted to be the manager of champions. That was her thing. So when the Body Donnas weren't quite cutting it anymore, she went over to the Smoking Guns and she managed them because they became the tag champs. Then she sort of flirted with the Godwins, who were babyfaces. When they won the titles, she obviously went with them. When they lost the titles, she left them again. She eventually got slopped for continuing to lead on Phineas Godwin all the time. So she ends up with bringing in Farouk because she wants to win another championship or be the manager of another champion. So that's kind of the history of how Sonny was with Farouk. And the Wild Man was with a very innocent and very overly dressed Sable, from what we would end up seeing from her in the future. What were your thoughts before we get into the match? So this is really built up. So you've got Mr. Perfect, who's the former Intercontinental Champion, who had been a commentator for the last kind of year or so. He's coming into the ring. He's presenting the championship.
You want to know a weird thing about that?
Mm-hmm.
I was like, his theme music is so slow. And it occurred to me that it's kind of an interesting representation of, like, how different my wrestling fandom is, because I'm like, I'm used to Curtis Axel's version of this theme, not Mr. Perfect's.
That's where we're going with this, ladies and gentlemen. His theme's a bit slow.
Well, no, but it was just, I was like, this is the original version, I guess, but it's like, you know, it's like Charlotte's version is way peppier than Ric Flair's version, and it's more fun.
I guess it's like if you've watched an updated, like a remake of a movie, and you see the remake before you see the original.
Yeah.
And then you go back and watch the original and go, oh, okay, this was the way it was done at first. So
I wasn't super sure why Mr. Perfect was on commentary for this.
That it will become apparent.
Okay.
Why? And then Pat Patterson was the referee. Pat Patterson, who won the first ever Intercontinental Championship in Rio de Janeiro, aka did not, got handed it to him.
Yep.
But any thoughts on Farouk with Sonny, Wild Man with Sable? I dread to even begin.
He a gladiator?
Yes.
Because, like, okay. What even is that, like, helmet deal that he's wearing? It's just, it looks like blue piece of cloth on his, like, it doesn't look like it's protecting him from anything. And he has, like, weird gladiator loincloth, like, it's all very Halloween costume, right? Like, it doesn't look good. It looks
like... You know what I love about it? I love how, like, the helmet is so shit, right?
It's so bad.
But he looks so aggressive in the helmet, which makes me laugh. Because he's clearly trying to be serious here.
That's like, the funniest part. Like, I just, so it makes serious. Me laugh even more that he is so serious. Like, I believe the American gladiators a lot more than I believe Farouk.
Farouk Assad. Don't forget his surname.
No, he doesn't have a surname on this show.
Oh, they've dropped it already, haven't they?
Yeah. No, he's just Farouk.
Yep, so his surname lasted like a month. So, yeah, so Farouk was Sonny, and then Mark Meadow was Sable. You know, it's funny, like a lot of people give Mark Meadow a lot of shit because he was the first guy to get a guaranteed contract in WWF. Well, I mean, obviously, like Hogan and Headliners probably had that before, but in terms of like a new guy coming in, he was the first guy to really get that. But I liked Wildman Mark Meadow. Like, he's got charisma.
I expected him, like, from everything I've heard about Mark Mero and from, like, I guess just the way he's remembered or talked about, I expected him to be a lot more shit than he was. I didn't expect him to be so flippy. Like, he was doing Hurricanranas and he was doing moonsaults and the Wild Man is that, like, admittedly kind of terrible splash because, like, nobody does a
The
splash
wild
on this
thing.
show. Yeah, the wild thing, whatever it is. But like nobody does a splash properly on this show. They all like land on their hands and knees. It's very strange. But yeah, like I guess I didn't expect him to be as quick. I expected him to just be
He's quite athletic.
bored. Yeah, he's quite athletic. Like he's insufferable, but
Why is he insufferable?
his promo afterward.
Well, we'll get to that, but you know, he's the thing
I
is,
just
like,
wanted
it's
him to tell. I just wanted to tell him to go start smiling with Apollo Crews and old school Bo Dallas. Fuck's sake! But like,
thing is, I can't even describe to you how glorious Mark Meadow gets, like, later
I
on.
mean, I know some of what's coming.
But it's so good, right? Because at this point, like, it's very clearly about the wild man Mark Meadow. He is a baby face, he loves Sable. They're a great couple. All's right with the world.
Another thing I'll say. Is I think this is the most emotion I've ever seen from Sable. Like, ever. Because I've seen a lot of clips of Sable, and she's like the original Eva Marie, right? Like, her face doesn't move, and she doesn't do anything. But in this
Which is funny,
match,
but
she actually was on the outside and cheering and, like, you know, pounding on the apron. And when she had her little confrontation with Sonny, like, I thought that was actually pretty decent. Like, did she just get a lot worse as time went on?
it's
Did they
interesting because
insert more plastic into her face and stop it from moving? Like, what happened?
what like because I always remember Sable, like, because Sable was so popular, and you know, like, I remember I can't believe I'm admitting this. I had a Sable poster on my wall
Of course you
when I was
did.
like 12, because that's me. Like, I'm the guy who has a Sable poster with her in some sort of mad leather cat suit thing, staring at me every night when I went to sleep. But so I remember her as being good because she was so popular, if that makes sense. So, like, it'll be interesting to actually go through all her stuff, because I only ever remember Sable as a positive thing because she had a really good run and she was really popular. So it's going to be, I'm going to do my best to not watch anything back before we watch it and talk about it.
And
But
I'm doing my best to not watch ahead too. Like, 'cause I want to record the episodes before I see the next weeks.
yeah, exactly. So, what did you think of overall the match, first of all? Mark Meadow and Farouk, because it felt to me watching this back that, and obviously it's different because for the next while, all we're going to be focusing on is three championships. You know, that's all there is. The WWF Championship, the IC Championship, and the tag titles. That's all there is. And it felt like this IC title final was a big deal.
It felt like a big deal, and they made it feel like a big deal on commentary. And like at first I didn't really get that it was the final of a tournament. I missed that the first time I watched it through. But I mean, I got that it was a big deal. That's why they had Pat Patterson there as a special guest referee. I mean, I thought the match was pretty good. There were definitely shenanigans afoot, right? Because they have Sonny get ejected, which again, like I know you love ejecting heel managers. I love ejecting
Oh,
heel
I love
managers. It's great when heel managers get caught with stuff and then get ejected. Like for some reason, she was allowed to walk back in, sporting
it.
that, you know, purse that looked not out of place at all. Because of course, managers are always carrying purses to the ring that don't match their dress at all and are just clearly there because they're holding a brick inside. I think.
I love that I don't bat an eyelid that she has a purse that does not match with her outfit, but you're just like immediately like, what is she
Well,
doing?
and I mean, like, I'm not someone who carries purses to match my outfit, but I feel like Sunny would be a person who would match herself, right? But this purse is clearly only there so that it can hold a brick. And I think it's hilarious at the end when, when after the match, she, like, takes the brick out of the purse to show it to the camera. Like, there's no other reason for her to take the brick out of the purse. Like, the match is over. Nothing's gonna happen. But she still wants to, just in case they check the purse after the match or something.
Yeah.
I don't know. It made me laugh. But I think the timing of it was good, though. Like, I actually, you know, we have plenty of feelings about Sunny on this show, right? Like, she's garbage. But as a performer, I will say, I enjoyed Sunny in this.
Sunny's really good.
She's really
like,
good.
Sunny is a great heel valet. And it's like, I'm going to enjoy the fact that we get to see about this, because often when Sunny is brought up in conversation, it's not in a good way. But like, she was so good here as the heel valet. And I think that Sable struggled emotionally to show the she struggled to show the emotion, you know, but that kind of added to it because she didn't feel that she was performing. You know, she felt that she was just genuine.
Maybe that's why this was some of the like most interested I've ever been in Sable. I mean, I wasn't like interested in her, but I wasn't annoyed by her presence either, because it just seemed like she was there to support her husband and be there, and it seemed more genuine. Maybe that's why it came across as she was having more emotion than I've ever seen from her, because it seems like she's just not a very good performer from all of the clips and things I've seen. I'm really interested to watch as, you know, as we go with this, but Sunny's such a natural at it. And I think her timing was great. And I think the only thing I didn't really like about the match so much, and part of this has to do with Mark Miro being a little insufferable and disingenuous. I was going to ask if the promo at the end was meant to be disingenuous in any way, because babyface ass Mark Miro, super babyface Mark Miro with, you know, hot wife, super supportive Sable on the outside. Mark Miro's the one that uses the purse to get the win. And like, I know that Farouk grabbed the purse first to try to use it, but Mark Miro, babyface of the world, could have thrown the purse away and then won legitimately. But no, he just whaps Farouk with the purse with the brick in it and then wins, and then is like, I'd like to thank my Lord and Savior Jesus Christ. And then I'm like, shouldn't you also think that brick in Sonny's purse? And then Jerry Lawler was like, he should be thanking Sonny because she is the one that brought it. I was like, fuck, I agreed with Jerry Lawler. That is not something I ever want to do, but he was right.
I love that you're agreeing with Jerry Lawler. That's already made this podcast worthwhile. I feel like that's going to be a theme where you're just going to hate yourself more and more because Jerry Lawler is the voice of reason. But I do want to say, before we get to the promo, I loved, first of all, about the disingenuous thing, or sorry, about him using the purse at the end. Like, I grew up watching Hulk Hogan, who cheated more than anybody ever realized. Like, Hulk Hogan was the biggest cheat going if there was an object. Like, it was almost like if a heel brings an object out, Hulk Hogan's going to use it to win. Like, because that was pretty much the ammo.
WWE babyfaces are the worst.
They are. I mean, they're
it's
better.
It's good to know that that isn't a recent development, that it's just always been. They are full of terrible people.
But what's interesting is Mark Merrill is kind of the blueprint of what WWF had as a babyface, and this is the beginning of that kind of dying out. Because, you know, Mark Merrill gets a big reaction when he wins,
mm-hmm.
and people are really behind it. And he does this kind of, you know, very traditional American babyface promo. He thanks God, he thanks his wife, he thanks Mr. Perfect, who's given him some advice and seems to be becoming his mentor now.
And then JR goes, what about me? You're a great guy.
Yeah. But what I did love was, I loved the part where Sunny goes to get up on the apron and Sable just yanks her down and they start slapping the shit out of each other. Like, I thought that was great because it brought up the intensity of the match, and it brought up how important it was for Sonny to win a championship, and then Sable kind of being like, you're not going to fucking stop my husband from winning here.
It gave Sable a purpose to be there too.
Yeah, like, she was going to get involved because she wasn't going to let Sonny ruin this, like Sonny had done to so many other people in the company in tag title matches. So, and then I did kind of love the whole thing of, like, after the match, Sonny is like putting the brick under the ring. Like, was that in case Farouk found it and dumped her, which he does, or like, was that because if the referee saw it, he was going to take away her manager's license? Like, who knows the reasons of which Sonny did it? But I did love her really cheesy
But like she didn't
facial
want to get
expression.
caught with the brick in her purse.
Yeah, it was almost like she was like sneaking out of a house or something, the way her
Yeah.
facial expression was. So yeah, that was good. But yeah, so Mark Merrow is the new Intercontinental Champion. We'll see where that goes on the show. Then we got
They
a
have that
shot.
weird locker room celebration afterwards, which I know comes after the shot that you're about to talk about, but like just Mark Miro's locker room celebration did not look that celebratory to me.
Now, did you spot Bob Holly?
I
Did you spot Mark
did.
Holly? Good. Okay.
I
I was wondering
actually
if you did.
have written down the only people I recognize. Mark Henry's in frame for just like a second. And then.
Who did you notice that America had vomited on him?
Yes. Yep. For sure. Yes.
He had
And.
just been signed. Like, he had
Didn't
not
he
had a
debut the
match
night
yet.
before against Lawler?
He did. He did. Sorry, he debuted at Mind Games, so he
Okay.
just debuted.
So, yeah, but like I recognize Bob Holly and I don't know who any of the other men were, but they were just standing there and Doc Hendricks, who knows what drugs he was on at the time, like he just looked way too excited and nobody
How
else was
weird was it
that
to see Michael
excited.
Hayes in his Doc Hendricks garb?
It was very strange. Mr. Sandra was like, "So how old is Doc Hendricks there at that point?"
35 years old.
Because he goes, "Is Doc Hendricks younger than me there?" And I go, "Yeah, I think so." And he doesn't look like he's younger than Mr. Sandra. It's very bizarre. It's very bizarre. But like Mark Miro's just standing there grinning, and Sable's grinning, and then everybody else is like, "Yeah, Mark Miro, when is the camera going to be off of us? Because we're kind of tired of pretending to be excited for you right now." It's very weird. But
And Doc Hendricks is like, "It's crazy back here, back to ringside." And
I
Kevin
know
Owens
he's
like,
like.
"This party's gonna be going on all night." And you're like, "What party? There's six people."
They're just standing there waiting for the camera to go away so they can go have a beer or something, most likely.
And they're all probably in real life raging that Mark Merrow earns more money than all of them. So
Probably, yeah.
yeah, it was a very, but again, like, that was a very old school thing. You would see all the baby faces congratulating the baby face winner of the title, or you'd see the same in the heel locker room. It's something that we don't really get now. So I'm curious, from your perspective as a newer fan who watches newer stuff, obviously I'm not using this as the exact blueprint of how to do it, but would you like to see something like that, of like, if a baby face wins, that you have all these other baby faces sort of congratulating them? Is that something that you would like or not?
Not necessarily, because it doesn't always make sense. Like, why would they all be friends?
True.
Because, I mean, just
Can't
because
we all just
you.
be good guys?
Well, I mean, like, they could congratulate him and be happy for him or whatever, but it doesn't really make that much sense all the time, because sometimes baby faces get along, sometimes they don't. I think I like more complex character relationships than just all of the good guys are friends and all of the bad guys are friends.
That's fair. That's fair. We do get a shot backstage of the dressing room of Razor and Diesel.
Which looked like a treehouse or like a boys only kind of a thing to me, because it just says Razor and Diesel, keep out. Like, they might as well have
obviously
just written no girls allowed.
pretty much. But again, what was interesting is at this point, Nash and Hall are in WCW, so
Yeah.
they're really building up the idea that Nash and Hall are going to show up in this show.
Oh, I. This was another thing during the first match. I kept count of how often JR screamed and ranted about how Razor and Diesel are going to be 4 times during the first match.
And at the beginning of the show, they show you the still photo of Mind Games, where you see from a very far distance Diesel and Razor beating up Savio Vega
Right.
the night before. But what's interesting, so Jim Ross at this point in this show, like, he's been there on and off for the last 3 years. He's always been straight up Jim Ross. And up until he gets in the ring later on, like, I don't remember thinking that any of it was weird.
I mean, he's insufferable throughout the entire show.
Which, but I think that's because when I was a kid, like, I just didn't really think about it too much, you know? So, like, I just thought, oh, well, like, JR's got the scoop. He's got Razor and Diesel. Great. Like, and I do remember I remember knowing that Razor and Diesel were in WCW. I remember knowing that Nash and Hall had gone. But then I remember kind of thinking, like, are they back? Because I never watched WCW at that point. Mm. So I maybe in my head I was like, Nash and Hall are back, like they're coming back. Or I thought the real Razor and Diesel, I wouldn't have called them Nash and Hall at that point. But I think as like the 11-year-old me thought, maybe Razor and Diesel are back. That'd be good.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting. It's interesting that like they kind of got you with it, I guess, because that was the intention, right?
That was the intention. But what they also wanted to do on this show, Sandra, was, you know, the war's heating up, so it's time to expose someone.
Oh, boy.
It's time to expose Jeff Jarrett for the singing of With My Baby Tonight. Sandra, take me through any questions, thoughts, desires, opinions that you have on this whole thing.
Oh boy, does this seem like a load of who could possibly care? Like, first of all, I never recognized Jeff Jarrett. I think Jeff Jarrett has one of those generic white man faces where I just, nope. Like, they showed footage of him against Shawn Michaels from July. And I was like,
Of 1995.
Yep. So this is over a year ago that he's been gone from the company, right?
Now, they didn't mention this, but I'm just bringing it up for context. He did briefly come back in December of 95 for like a week.
Okay.
And he smashed Ahmed Johnson over the head with a guitar, and Ahmed Johnson no-sold it, and that's pretty much all that happened.
Okay, so like, but yeah, didn't matter. And it mattered enough that they didn't mention it. So this has been over a year that Jeff Jarrett's been gone. And so they show footage of him. And then they show the locker room celebration, I think. And then they go back to exposing Jeff Jarrett, right? Like, who cares? He sang this song over a year ago. And, like, the thing is, I know where this goes. So, who cares?
You know what they were trying to do?
I think what they were trying to do... Like, was Jeff Jarrett important enough that anybody cared about Jeff, like, what was he doing in WCW that they thought this was going to get attention?
He hadn't debuted yet in WCW, but...
So he was just gone?
He debuts in October of 96, but I would bet money that he had either signed or was signing at that point, because that's why they would expose him. That's why they would sort of bitch him out on TV.
For signing but with again, WCW.
For signing with WCW. But again,
but
that's...
who cares?
But this was... You know, this was the era where, like, Eric Bischoff would open... So, you know how, like, this is in Hershey, Pennsylvania?
Yeah.
So, the night that they recorded this show, they recorded the next 4 weeks of Raw.
Okay.
So, every Raw up until Buried Alive is in this arena.
Okay.
So, like, what Eric Bischoff would do at the beginning of Nitro sometimes would be give away the results, because he could, because... there was 4 weeks of tape stuff. So this was kind of like one of WWF's retaliations of, you know, we're going to expose this fraud and take something that was ours and try and make something out of it by having the real guy come forward and hopefully become a star. He would, but just not the way that they anticipated him doing it.
Yeah, it's so bizarre, because I was wondering if Jeff Jarrett was on TV in WCW at this point or not, or whatever. Like, I mean, this seems like if WWE today were to be like, so we have this big scoop about Justin Gabriel.
I love that you're putting it. I mean, to be fair, Jeff Jarrett was a bigger star than Justin Gabriel, but I take your point. I mean, Jeff Jarrett was... I'm trying to compare him to someone in the roster today. He would be on the level of a Dolph Ziggler.
Okay.
So that's kind of the level you're looking at.
But even so, I mean...
But this was just an era where they were doing any chance that either promotion got to sort of stick it to the other, or...
But I'm just wondering if it even came across on TV, though, because if Jeff Jarrett's not even on TV in WCW, would the audience even get it? Like...
Probably not. I mean, I don't know if I can really sort of back this as a really successful creative endeavor at all. But I will say this, I remember at the time for about 6 months that I could not get With My Baby Tonight out of my head.
I have not been able to get it out of my head for the past few days. it has been constantly in my head, and I blame you, and I blame Jeff Jarrett, and I blame the Road Dog, and
you
I blame everyone involved.
You mean you blame Jesse James?
Whoever the fuck he's going to be, I blame him for singing the song.
Real Double J, that's who he's going to be.
Oh my gosh, is that what they do?
Yeah.
Is that why they say the real, oh my goodness. That's just too funny. Because like, because I was going to say, like, the only reason they're doing this is I assume Road Dogg, Jesse James, the roadie.
Real Double J, Jesse James, that's his name.
Sure, him, that guy. He's probably debuting soon.
I cannot wait to hear you talk about the entire presentation of that. There's so much fun to come.
I'm so excited. Like, this is genuinely why this is so much fun, because there's just so much bizarre stuff going on. But yeah, like, was Milli Vanilli a relevant reference at this point either?
I'm not the guy to ask that to. You're the American. You know.
I am the American. I'm just trying to remember when Milli Vanilli was a thing, and it seems like it was.
Is that only 91, 92?
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. I was thinking it was like way early. So, yeah. Calling Jeff Jarrett, who hasn't been in the company for over a year, the equivalent of country music's Milli Vanilli, a reference from way earlier in the decade. And Vince McMahon just sounds so gleeful as he's narrating this. Like, it just seems like one of those Vince McMahon, ha ha ha, pal, I'm going to stick it to you, and nobody else gives a shit at all kind of thing.
That's one of the things that's going to be fascinating about going through this is that, you know, I don't want to say we're going to, but if we were to delve into the pay-per-views as we go along here, it's going to be fun to see you basically see a completely different Vince McMahon.
Yeah.
Like, not Mr. McMahon whatsoever, just commentating Vince McMahon.
Well, and I'll get more into this when we talk about JR later, but Vince McMahon was not supposed to be a heel at all at this point, right?
Nope. Well, we'll get to that. We'll get to that in the main segment.
Okay.
Then we get up next a non-title match with the Body Donnas, Skip and Zip, with their great infomercial theme tune against the British Bulldog and Owen Hart. The one tag team that I think I let away with not having a tag team name in history, I think. I don't know why.
They didn't have a tag team name ever?
No. British Bulldog and Owen Hart. That was it.
Wow.
Now, they had been managed by Jim Cornette for ages. Now, at this time, I don't know if this is bizarre to you. So Shawn Michaels, as he was training for his Iron Man match with Bret Hart at WrestleMania 12, the guy who had trained him in Texas was called Jose Lothario, or Lothario, whatever you pronounce it, who was this old Mexican man, and he came out at WrestleMania 12 to introduce Shawn Michaels, and then he basically became his manager.
Mm-hmm.
So Shawn Michaels at this point is managed by Jose Lothario. And at SummerSlam, Shawn Michaels fought Vader. Vader was managed by Jim Cornette. Shawn was managed by Jose. And then at Mind Games, Jose Lothario finally had a match with Jim Cornette. And I use the term match very loosely. For what those two gentlemen did. And Jim Cornette at the time, you know, he was managing Vader, he was managing the British Bulldog and Owen Hart, and Clarence Mason, who was Jim Cornette's legal representative, Clarence Mason took advantage of Jim Cornette, Sandra.
Yes, they showed him getting Jim Cornette to sign over the British Bulldog and Owen Hart.
I love Clarence this so Mason. Much. Like, I love that, like, you can basically trick someone when they're, like, unconscious to sign over. That's what you had to do. You had to sign over your team to someone else.
Yeah.
Like, that's how important being a manager to somebody was. Like, oh, God, I love that shit. So,
I will say, Clarence Mason, I just love his facial expressions. He looks
Don't
like
you love his...
He's trying to be, like, lost or something. He's just like, what? What? No, I didn't do anything wrong. I'm an honorable man. He's so full of shit. I like Clarence Mason. You know what he is? He's, like, the opposite of David Otunga. He's what David Otunga wants to be and fails so miserably.
Oh, that is the quote of this podcast. David Otunga tries and fails to be Clarence Mason.
It's true, though. Like, Clarence Mason seems like he has so much personality and he's so interesting. And, like, I mean, I liked some of David Otunga's backstage legal stuff, but David Otunga in promos, and goodness knows we hear him on commentary every week on SmackDown, like, he just never sounds like he's very good at speaking. Like, he always sounds kind of disingenuous or, like, scripted or whatever. And Clarence Mason was great. I was kind of into Clarence Mason, actually.
So Clarence Mason, this was his first match managing the British Bulldog and Owen Hart. They defeated the Body Donnas in a, you know, fine match. It was fine. And at the end, Clarence Mason ran into the ring like a spaniel and did a happy dance, which made my day.
It was beautiful.
So what did you think of the whole presentation? Any questions, any thoughts about the Body Donnas, Bulldog and Owen?
Okay, shouldn't a team called the Body Donnas be, like, way prettier than these guys?
But, so this is the thing you've missed as well, is that it used to be in wrestling that if you were ever called, like, anything pretty, you pretty much never were.
Like, Ravishing Rick Rude was all Mr. Bodybuilder-y, though, right? Like,
well, I mean, I don't know. Was Ravishing Rick Rude an attractive man?
Well, not to me. He looks kind of sleazy.
So yeah, that's what I mean. But it's like, so it's very rare that, like, the attractive people are the people who have those kind of gimmicks. It's more the kind of uggos that have the over the top gimmicks.
But I mean, Rick Rude was still jacked, though. You know, he was all muscly and
stuff. Oh, so you mean you mean that the Body Donnas should have been in better shape to be the
Body Donnas? Like, okay. Because there's, and they weren't very good either. And I don't know which is which, and I keep wanting to call them Chip and Dip, but
Chip and Dip.
Yeah, like,
oh, that's so good, Chip and Dip.
Because there's
skip
the
and zip,
skip and zip, flip and pip. I don't know what they're called. Right,
Nick, do you remember which one's which? Who is Tom Pritchard and who is Chris Candido?
I have no idea. There's, like, there's the smaller one, and then there's the big lumpy one who was really slow.
The lumpy one is Tom Pritchard.
Okay.
He is which one?
Well, what's I keep calling him Dip, but fuck if I know. I don't know. I have no idea which is which. I could barely tell them apart.
Well, that's because the thing that's funny is, so Tom Pritchard used to be in the Heavenly Bodies, a tag team that Jim Cornette managed in WWF.
So he went from being a Heavenly Body to a Body Donna, and he looks like that?
Well, wait, Google him as a Heavenly Body and look at his hair then. And he's bleached it and cut it for the role as a Body Donna. But Bulldog and Owen, any thoughts on them as a team?
I mean, they seemed good. So much of the match was focused on Jim Cornette and Clarence Mason that the match seemed very inconsequential, which was kind of unfortunate because I was like, Owen Hart and Bulldog are in the ring. I know that they're good. I would like to pay more attention to them. But the match didn't really seem to be much of anything because, like, they kept going backstage to Jim Cornette. And so, I mean, I guess, like, it was good. Owen Hart's splash wasn't very good because, again, like, nobody does a splash on this show without landing on their hands and knees. But overall, I mean, it seemed like the wrestling was decent, but not the whole point of the segment.
Yeah, that's fair. Then we get...
Oh, the other thing about the Body Donnas is that I realized this must be what it was like, before the Revival were the tag team champions and super awesome, and, like, before people believed me how good they were. This must have been, like, when everyone was chanting, which one's Dawson, which one's Dash? Body Donnas. No That's idea true. Who's who.
Nobody ever chanted that at Skip and Sonny when they were together. So then we get a promo from The Undertaker. Now, to clarify this for you, the night after WrestleMania 12, The Undertaker was attacked by the debuting Mankind. And they ended up having a match at King of the Ring where Mankind beat The Undertaker clean. And at SummerSlam, so Paul Bearer had been with Undertaker pretty much his whole WWF career from, like, beginning of 91 right through. And then Mankind and Undertaker had a boiler room brawl. Undertaker finally is about to win and Paul Bearer out of no, like legitimately out of nowhere. Like nobody saw, I never saw it coming anyway. Paul Bearer turns heel on The Undertaker, smashes him in the head with the urn. Undertaker has been betrayed by his closest confidant, and it leads to mind games. Mankind gets a WWF Championship shot against Shawn Michaels, an excellent match. If MD's not checked it out, it's very much worth checking out. And near the end, there's shenanigans ahoy, and Mankind wants to put Shawn Michaels in the casket that's lying at ringside. And in possibly one of the best facial expressions of all time, Paul Bearer opens the casket and inside it. Now, this was like the rule in WWF. 9 out of 10 times, if you opened a casket, The Undertaker was inside it. That's pretty much the rule. But Paul Bearer looks so shocked at The Undertaker being in that casket. Oh, it was so great. So The Undertaker basically gets involved. Shawn Michaels ends up retaining his championship. But we get a promo here from The Undertaker in a graveyard. Quite an eerie promo talking about betrayal.
You say quite an eerie promo. It was every Undertaker promo ever.
True, but back then, at least this one had a purpose. And he was talking about the betrayal of Paul Bearer, what he's going to do to Mankind, buried alive. And I said this to you last night, like, I think in this kind of 30 seconds, Undertaker probably did more as a character than in the entire 5 years that you've seen him. So,
no, that's no accurate.
No pressure, you don't have, I'm not, and you know, all joking aside, this we're not doing this to try and get Sondra Toy down. It's not the purpose. But what did you think of this promo and the kind of lead up to Buried Alive with The Undertaker?
It was every Undertaker promo ever. Like, it was, I'm sorry. Like, I liked the presentation of it because it was in, like, a creepy graveyard and the music and going, ooh, and everything. And that was kind of neat. And it was all dark and the In Your House logo wasn't. I really wanted the In Your House logo to be flashing in the background just to add, you know, the same ambiance as on the gravestone in the Raw entrance. But, I mean, it's The Undertaker has, like, the same promo and it's always just super creepy and blah 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 and death. And there was one point where he says that he has one scar that I shall carry for all eternity, and I went, is it an emotional scar? And then The Undertaker goes, the scar of betrayal. And I was like, it is, it is an emotional scar, just like your brother.
What makes me laugh so much is that there's so many comparisons with The Undertaker and Bray Wyatt.
So many. And I feel like we're going to be seeing more and more and more of it. And it's so crazy to me because, like, Bray Wyatt is constantly just like, I am a god and I am the face of fear and blah, blah, blah. And The Undertaker's like, you will never rest in peace. Yes, I know. Okay, got it. Check.
We cut to Doc Hendricks backstage trying to chat to Razor Ramon. We see Razor from behind. The door slammed. More oohing and aahing for the main event. Doc Hendricks, a very good reporter, Sandra.
A very good reporter, yep. JR at this point. Well, of course, Doc Hendricks, it's my interview. They're going to be here live. I guarantee it. Because all throughout this episode, he's going on and on. And on. And I'm like, I get it. Razor and Diesel are here. Got it, JR. This from the man who's like, I just want the wrestling to be the star of the show. I just wish commentary would focus on the in-ring product.
The irony. But before we get the main event match, Steve Austin is on commentary here. When he's, I totally popped for his old theme music before he had the glass. I forgot about it. So that popped me that his music was playing. And then Jerry Lawler, oh, I miss when Jerry Lawler used to be an absolute scumbag as an intentional character. And so, like, here he's, like, putting over his own cartoon work, and then he's making fun of Bret Hart, and he passes it over to Steve Austin, and Steve Austin... So the story here is that Bret Hart, when he lost to Shawn Michaels at WrestleMania 12, was taking, like, a year off. That was the plan. Or 6 months off. So he did a couple of, like, foreign tours, but that was it. He wasn't doing anything else. So at this point, he's still not back. And the rumor mill was, is he going to join WCW? Because WCW had made an offer to Bret because his contract was going to be up in the October. That's where we are.
Okay. Because, so, I mean, they talked about it during Bulldog versus... not Bulldog versus Ownhart, Bulldog and Ownhart versus, you know, Chip and Dip. And they were talking about Bret Hart being scared of Steve Austin. And then Steve Austin was on commentary for Triple H versus The Stalker. Oh, boy.
We'll get to that.
We'll get to that. But my question is, why is Steve Austin on this match on commentary?
Because there's no real reason.
This didn't really seem to have anything to do with Steve Austin or Bret Hart.
I think it was just a way to get him on the show.
Okay.
And have him involved. That was really it. But my favorite part was that Steve Austin was so good at insults. Like, it's not even funny. Like, he was saying he's not allowed to use the language that he wants to, so he said he'll just rhyme it instead. And he said, "I spit on the life, career, and family of Bret Hart." And then he says, "But if his parents had practiced safe sex 30 years ago, I wouldn't have to have this conversation."
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, so good. And you know, like, this is one of the, you know, take notes, WWE, like, the Bret Hart Steve Austin story is so great. And this is like just the beginning of it, you know, and already it's just Steve Austin's so good. So then we get Hunter Hearst Helmsley versus The Stalker.
Now, I always thought he came out to Ode to Joy.
Who, Hunter?
Yeah.
No, this was his theme. Wait, he does come out to Ode to Joy in about 6 months.
Okay.
But this was his first theme for the first kind of 18 months of his career. So now, I don't know if you knew this trivia fact. So Hunter Hearst Helmsley's gimmick was that he would bring an attractive lady to the ring every time he comes out, because he was a rich blue blood and always had a attractive woman on his side and all that.
So he always bought a different woman. Gotcha.
He always bought a different woman because, you know, that's what you did in the 90s, Sandra.
Is Triple H the original Godfather?
I think he was, actually. But he didn't have a good run of luck, because at WrestleMania 12, he basically tried to get Sable. He had Sable as a valet around WrestleMania 12, and Mark Merrill took Sable from him because he didn't like the way that Sable was being treated, so he stuck up for her, and Sable ended up going with Mark Merrill. So it was this weird thing where, like, at the beginning, the story is that Mark Merrill kind of is the hero that comes to save the day for Sable.
So he, like, rescued Sable from the dark, dastardly
oppression,
prostitution ways of Hunter Hearst Helmsley.
But then, kind of somewhere in that story, it just kind of is revealed that they're actually husband and wife.
Like you do.
We forget about that. So Hunter comes out with an attractive lady. So just before we get into the match or his opponent, Hunter Hearst Helmsley as a blue blood and a character, what were your thoughts?
I mean, I knew that this was a thing. So if I hadn't known that this was a thing, I would probably have a lot more thoughts on it. But it's just, I mean, it is bizarre seeing him curtsy. And I knew about the whole, like, lady stealing Mr. Perfect thing from listening to reviews of, you know, old shows and whatnot. So I kind of vaguely knew what was going on. But, I mean, he didn't seem to be much of a thing. It's weird to think that this was the main event of the show. I mean, it wasn't actually, because the segment with JR and Razor and Diesel, who are here live, I swear. It's not even Diesel. Diesel never even comes out. But he's Hunter Hearst Helmsley. He's a snob, I guess.
And he hadn't quite taken his supplements yet at this point.
No. He looked fairly normal.
And his opponent.
His opponent is the most glorious thing.
Go ahead.
So, The Stalker. First of all,
the baby face of the equation.
Yeah, you make a good point. The Stalker was the baby face in this match, wasn't he? That didn't even occur to me. Oh boy, that adds another layer to this. So, The Stalker. Wrestling thought, you know what a good gimmick would be? The Stalker. Like, first of all, that alone is bizarre. Then you see The Stalker. And this is like the unfolding of events for me, right? Because I don't know what a lot of wrestlers look like. I've heard a lot of names, but like the locker room celebration, I didn't recognize most of the people in that room. Well, I knew who Savio Vega was because his name was on the back of his shirt. So that was the other one that I knew who he was, but I wouldn't have been able to pick him out of a lineup without the name Savio Vega written across his back. So I didn't really know what Barry Windham looked like. So I know that there's a man, and he's called the Stalker, and he just looks amazing. He has face paint, he's wearing camo, but what really makes the Stalker so great is the big blonde bushy mustache.
Or the theme tune.
Or the theme tune. Like, the theme tune's great, but there's something about that big blonde mustache sticking out of, like, the dark
black
Stalker
paint.
Face paint. Black paint. So there is a stark contrast. Like, you call a man a stalker, you give him, like, a super stalkery mustache, and then you have him paint his face? That's all amazing. Then on commentary, they say, Barry Windham, the Stalker. Wait, what? That's Barry Windham? I've heard of Barry Windham. Barry Windham is legendary. Barry Windham is, like, you know, related to Bray Wyatt. What in the world? Why is Barry Windham the Stalker? At one point on commentary, Steve Austin actually says, you know, why is he painting his face? Why is he wearing all that? We all know who he is. Is he embarrassed? Is he trying to not be recognized? We all know who you are, dude. Which was kind of like, I don't know, are you supposed to call that out? Like, because they introduce him as Barry Windham the Stalker. They're not pretending that he's someone else. All of this is just so baffling to me.
I think you've accurately described everything. The thing that's funny is, like, so Barry Windham, as you mentioned, Barry Windham, the Hall of Famer.
Yep. Hall of Famer, the Stalker.
Legendary Barry Windham. He never really seemed to find much luck in the World Wrestling Federation. Well, he did initially. Initially, he was signed to the WWF and teamed with Mike Rotunda, who would later go on to be IRS, and they were the US Express. They were a babyface tag team. They wrestled at the first ever WrestleMania. They were tag team champions. They were, you know, they won the tag team titles from, I think it was Dick Murdoch and Adrian Adonis. Like, they were a big deal. They even won the tag titles a second time. They were in the WWF. They were mainstays. And then he went away and had some success in Crockett and WCW, NWA. Then he returns to the WWF in 1989. Only I've never seen any of it, because you can buy the 1989 Survivor Series videotape, and on the back of the videotape it has all of, because you know they used to do, like, every match was a Survivor Series match, like elimination match.
Oh, okay.
And on the back of the videotape it would show you all the teams, because all the teams would always have to, like, do a photo shoot for their team to have the matches. So, like, you would, on the back of the covers, you would have, you know, left-hand side babyface team, right-hand side heel team, blah, 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 blah. And on the team that had Randy Savage on it as the captain, there was randomly Barry Windham in the photo. But he never was on the pay-per-view. And I always kind of wondered, like, what was that? So he ended up being replaced by Earthquake. But Barry Windham came to the WWF in June of 1989 as the Widowmaker.
The Widowmaker.
He was a heel, kind of like cowboy thing. Never wrestled on a pay-per-view. I've never seen any of his matches from that run. So that was his second run in the WWF.
So he didn't wear a mask or anything as the Widowmaker. He just was a cowboy?
Yep. Never wore a hat. So that was his second run.
Then what even is the point?
He ends up going back to WCW. He becomes world champion. Like, all these sort of things. He has great TV title matches with Steve Austin. Did he win the world title? No, I think he was going to. Or did he win it? I think he won it. Anyway, he was at least in contention. So then he comes back to the WWF again in 1996 to be the Stalker. From the environment. That's where the Stalker's from.
He's from the environment.
Did you not hear that?
No, I missed that part. I was too distracted by the mustache.
The Stalker. And then,
that makes it even, every new detail I learn about the Stalker makes him my favorite wrestler.
So, like, he wins the match, right? Now, he wins with a superplex, because somebody can win with a superplex, apparently.
But, I mean, the only reason he wins it is because Mr. Perfect does stop leading the backstage celebration for Mark Miro at some point. He shuts down the party so that he can come out to steal Triple H's lady. Exactly. And Triple H, you know, 2014 diva style, is so distracted.
But the best thing about it is, so Hunter Hearst Helmsley is so distracted by Mr. Perfect trying to take his lady that he has paid
for. Shouldn't the stalker be the one stealing women?
This is true. I didn't think of that. Yeah, maybe. Well, no. Because he doesn't steal. He just stalks.
Oh. So he's just going to watch Mr. Perfect and the lady later?
He's just going to stay in the environment and watch. But the thing that is funny to me is, like, so Hunter Hearst Helmsley. Now, I do encourage you, for every week that we do these, watch them on the network with us. Like, watch this along with us. Because we want to hear what you guys think as well. And so Triple H...
And it's only an hour. It's great.
Yeah, enjoy it while we can. So Hunter Hearst Helmsley sees his lady being taken. And instead of, like, getting out of the ring, he decides to climb yes. to the top. Which I don't know why he does that, because he would then have to climb down again to then...
He going to, like, dive onto them? Like what was his end game?
No idea. No unearthly idea. So he does this, and eventually, you know, the stalker wins with a superplex.
Because Hunter Hearst Helmsley, I need to stop calling him Triple H. Hunter Hearst Helmsley gets crotched due to his inability to get out of the ring properly. The stalker takes advantage of the situation and crotches him, and then wins with a superplex.
That's what you. And so Steve Austin is just like flabbergasted that Hunter Hearst Helmsley would allow this to happen to himself. And then Barry Windham, because by this point the face paint is nearly non-existent. He's got his hair in a ponytail for whatever reason.
Because the stalker. That is why.
Have you ever seen a more depressed winner in your life?
No, I haven't. Like,
he is so depressed that he has won. So Barry Windham leaves, and the stalker reigns on, I guess.
I guess so.
Baffled. Absolutely baffled. But the thing is, we're not even anywhere near the end of Barry Windham's unsuccessful WWF run, because there's more to come.
Oh, I'm so excited to see what happens now.
Oh, God. So then we get Jim Ross in the ring, and he is about to try and bring out Razor Ramon when So what's funny is Hunter Hearst Helmsley is getting out the ring, and as he's getting out the ring, Jim Ross is already in the ring, because he's like, we've not got a lot of time left, we need to get to this now. And he tries to start his promo, then they go to a commercial break, they come back. So
there's one point I do have to interrupt about this commercial break, because there's an ad for the Superstar line. Option 6 on the Superstar line, which costs $1.49 a minute, but you have to ask your parents' permission. Option 6 is to find out why Razor and Diesel attack Savio Vega. Like, isn't that literally what JR is about to ask them in this interview, theoretically?
Apparently. So it's a good point. You have called out the scamming nature of the WWF Superstar line.
I'm just saying.
It's true. I get it. So we come back from the commercial break, and it's JR in the ring. And so
you missed the Mankind Paul Bearer promo, too.
Oh, yeah, sorry.
They interrupt him twice. They do it first for the Mankind Paul Bearer promo. So squeaky, by the way. Like,
so what did you? So Mankind Paul Bearer as a team.
I kind of love it. Like, I love Paul Bearer. Paul Bearer was around when I started watching wrestling. And, I mean, because one of the first storylines I remember, so this is an interesting view into my wrestling history too. One of the first storylines that I remember with clarity, and one of my favorite things, admittedly, is when Edge was world champion, or maybe Kane was world champion, but like, I think Edge had won it, but then he kidnapped Paul Bearer, and it's like, you know, you and Robert have always joked about how, like, he kidnapped Paul Bearer and, like, had him tied up in his wheelchair on the plane because, like, they filmed an episode of Raw in London or something, and Paul Bearer was still kidnapped and tied up. Mm-hmm. That is one of my first wrestling stories.
See, folks, this, you can explain it so much. But the weird thing is, because Paul Bearer was always this over-the-top character, but he was always... You know, the Undertaker's guy. So he was always just like, oh, yes. And he didn't really say much. But now he's just like cutting mad promos left, right, and center. And And I do kind of love the, I love the relationship with Mankind Paul Bearer, of like, Paul Bearer's kind of like his dad now. Like, it's
Well,
like
he's Uncle Paul.
Uncle Paul. He's
He
kind
calls
of.
him Uncle Paul. And Mankind, like, I really like them as a pair. They seem very, like, for some reason it seems to fit. Like, they're very creepy and weird, and I still don't necessarily understand why Paul Bearer would go with Mankind instead of the Undertaker, given the history of it, but I kind of really like the two of them just squeaking at each other. Because they both talk in such high-pitched noise, and it was just bizarre, because whereas the Undertaker just sort of like wandered through the graveyard and spouted, blah blah blah, death, emotional scars, they were like, and we're in a graveyard, and bah, and this is gonna happen, and right here, Undertaker, this is where we're gonna bury you. And Mankind like starts digging dirt, and I swear he was like eating a handful of dirt or something at one point, because why not? Like, just to show this is how you dig in the ground, and this is how we're gonna bury you alive. They were just very animated and very into it, and they made definite mention of, and we have the urn, and da 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 da. I do want to know how anyone who's watched, and like, obviously, here at Inside the Ropes, we're big fans of the Final Deletion and Delete or Decay. I really want to know how people who aren't fans of that and think that that's too over the top were also such big fans of this as children.
That's a fair. I mean, the thing is, I love both, so I'm not the
Which
guy
is
to ask.
fine. I mean, I'm not saying don't like this. I'm just wondering, because there
But
are
again,
some people who were critical of Delete or Decay and the
there
Final
are they are
Deletion.
idiots, and they will be punished for doing so.
And I'm guessing that some of those people are also the people going, how could Sandra not like The Undertaker? The Undertaker has been amazing all zillion years of his career.
Thing is, you wonder why people keep bringing up the Undertaker. You keep throwing shade at Mr. Calloway. It's
Well,
that.
everybody keeps bringing it up. I might as well bring it up too. Plus, he was on this show.
He was on this show. So finally we get the Jim Ross promo. Now, at this point I'd watched WWF from like 92 to the end of 94. Then I fell out of love with WWF for like a year. And then WrestleMania 12 was my first pay-per-view that I watched back. And then by about SummerSlam, I was able to see most of the Saturday morning TV. I didn't have Sky, but somebody taped the shows for me. So I never knew at this point that Vince McMahon was the owner of WWF.
Really?
I was made aware of this by this promo.
That's so interesting.
Which, because if you think about it, I'm 11 years old. I live in Scotland. I have no idea what the Wrestling Observer is. And it was only about a couple of months after this that I started buying Power Slam, because 1996 was a weird year for me as a wrestling fan, because you're about to start going through puberty, so things are changing, and then wrestling's really changing quite drastically, and there's a lot of kind of shoot stuff being thrown about. So this was the first year where I was kind of like questioning things in wrestling and what was going on and what was real and what was not. So Jim Ross starts cutting this promo, which at the time baffled me because I had no idea that he'd been fired twice and that he'd left Atlanta and he didn't want to show any loyalty to the World Wrestling Federation. But I'm curious for you, watching this promo and seeing Jim Ross talk about all this stuff, which everything he mentions in this promo is real and did happen. So he's not lying about any of it. He is just essentially shooting in this promo. What did you think of it?
How is he the bad guy? Like,
Yeah, you're right.
I don't. That's why I was curious to know when you did watch this. It's really interesting that this was what, revealed Vince McMahon as the owner of WWF to you. Because when you were watching this when you were 11, did you think, how dare JR turn on the WWF? Or did you think, well, that was rather unfair of Vince McMahon.
I remember being firmly in Jim Ross's corner.
Okay, so it's not just me.
No, but then again, I remember, and we'll get to it later on, I remember being in Vince McMahon's corner against Steve Austin initially.
Okay.
Because Steve Austin was the one who was being the bad guy. in a lot
well,
of ways.
Well, he was. That's one of the interesting things about Steve Austin as a character. But, so, I mean, as JR is talking about this, and there's a lot to unpack here about.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot to unpack here, right? And unfortunately, I do need to get to work fairly soon, but we will go into it. So, yeah, as I'm watching it, I'm just wondering, because the history, according to WWE, and, like, the history of the Monday Night War is that Mr. McMahon as a, you know, bad guy, as a character, happened after the Montreal Screwjob in 1997. Mm-hmm. That's what you always hear. And it's bizarre to me, because this is September 1996, and Vince McMahon doesn't seem like a very good guy here. Like, Vince McMahon is exposing Jeff Jarrett, who could possibly care. And then JR's like, so Vince McMahon fired me because I got sick. Like, who's not going to be sympathetic for JR at this point? And I think part of it is that, you know, I don't understand the concept of being so loyal to the WWF, I guess, just because wrestling fans nowadays, like, wrestling fans of the WWE are also the ones shitting on WWE, like, most of the time, right? So
yeah,
social
media has really changed how a lot of people are fans.
Yeah, and I mean, I guess the closest thing I have to it is being loyal to things like NXT or Lucha Underground or Chikara, because those as promotions, like, I do feel a lot of loyalty towards. So if people,
well, it's funny because in a way you are loyal to WWE.
I am, yeah. In a way, yeah,
the thing that's interesting. So Vince McMahon in real life had wanted Jim Ross to turn heel for a couple of years. He wanted him to do like a J.R. Ewing from Dallas thing.
Yeah, I never watched Dallas, but
so with the cowboy hat and all that sort of stuff. Mm-hmm. So he would eventually get him to do the cowboy hat, but this was, you know, this was Jim Ross having to turn heel, and you know, cheap plug ahoy, but I'm going to ask Jim Ross about this in detail when we speak to him and Jim Cornette.
I actually was thinking as we were going through, like, as I was watching this episode, I was like, this is exactly the stuff you're going to get to talk to them about on stage.
Yeah, which,
and it's going to be really interesting, I bet.
It's going to be great. But yeah, I mean, you're right, though, because a lot of the stuff that Jim Ross says here, you're like, how is he the heel? And the interesting part comes in that in a couple of weeks, we're going to have them both on commentary and see how that plays out.
Hmm.
Which is interesting. And also, they started Livewire around this time, which I might get us to watch a Livewire and do a little bonus thing for VIP, if we get that up and running soon, because Livewire was this weird show where they kind of just, it was like a shoot show completely.
Okay.
So like fans would call in and ask questions about WCW and stuff.
Hmm.
And Jim Ross is on it one of the weeks, and he just tears every caller to shreds. It's great. It's like somebody will phone in and go, what do you think of the Roddy Piper Hulk Hogan match from Halloween Havoc? And Jim Ross will be like, I like watching real wrestling. Goodbye.
That so sounds amazing, actually.
It's kind of great. But I loved this period of JR. Like, I really did. But
bizarre to me because JR, from what I know, is always the person who's like, I want the focus to be in ring and whatnot. And then this whole episode, he's banging on about Razor and Diesel. And then another weird thing is, and we can kind of get into when Razor Ramon comes out. If this were actually my first episode of Raw, I would have no idea what was going on.
No, none. Because the whole thing is, it all leads up to Jim Ross saying, because he talks about working in the front office and you know, he's not saying it, but he's kind of saying, you know, I'm the reason guys like Steve Austin and Mick Foley are here.
Mm-hmm.
I'm the reason that guys like the old generation are gone. You know, that's what he's trying to say. And then he's trying to say, so I'm going to bring back one of your favorites, Razor Ramon. But what he's actually doing is making a mockery of the WWF and sort of making fun of the fact that they don't have Hall and Nash anymore.
Well, and this is the weird thing to me, too, because, again, like, historically, the line that I'm always hearing from people who review older shows or who talk about history and who talk about fake Diesel and fake Razor is that this was an example of Vince McMahon's ego, right? Like, Vince McMahon thought that he could just bring these characters back in and nobody would notice or nobody would care. Or the reason he did it is he thought the characters were so over and it didn't matter who was playing them.
You know Vince McMahon sued WCW, right?
Over, yeah.
Over Nash and Hall, saying that they were basically being the characters.
And yeah, then, without and, using the names.
And yeah, so here was the retaliation. Here was, yeah, I'll use the gimmicks and they'll get over no matter who it is.
What I don't understand, though, about that line of thinking of history is if he thought that it was the characters that were so over, why would he bring them in such a heelish way where it's clear that them not being Scott Hall and Kevin Nash is meant to be a mockery? Like, that doesn't seem so much like he thought the characters would still be over and totally work, because it seems like they're being brought in as a mockery thing because JR's being the heel doing it. Like, there's a disconnect there for me.
Yeah, I think the thing that's fascinating is I really, watching it back, I've not watched it back in a good few years, but I thought JR was money in this promo. Like, I thought he was great in his delivery, believable, and...
Well, and another thing that made him seem super babyface to me is that they keep interrupting him. Like...
And that the fans keep cheating him as well, during all of his...
Well, but I mean, like, he's... They're trying to do it to be like, oh, JR is trying to be petulant or something, and, like, he keeps getting interrupted for ad breaks or for promos or whatever... But really, the guy's just trying to do his job. Like, he's trying to get an interview with these, like, prominent characters and whatnot, and they keep interrupting him. Like, that seems like a dick move and makes me have sympathy for JR, because how frustrating would it be if you're trying to, you know, get an interview done and someone's constantly like, hey, nope, ad break, hey, nope, this.
Are they basically trying to do that because they know he can't deliver the real raison d'etre and they don't want him to do it? Is that part of what the attempt? But see, I know what you mean. That's where the disconnect is, because we can't quite work out what they're trying to do.
I mean, like, and what's going to be interesting, seeing how they deal with this next week, I guess.
Yeah, and I interviewed Rick Bogner, who played the fake Razor. So I'll put a clip of that up on my Twitter page and the Inside the Ropes Twitter page that you can listen to, and we'll have the full interview up on our VIP site that launches soon. But yeah, and then at the end, as I really did, I commend them on the camera work of when he introduces Razor Ramon, the camera cuts away just as he's about to come out. So you see like a glimpse of him. So right up into the whole minute. And it's like you hear Kevin Kelly, like he goes, here he is, Razor Ramon. And like he just changes his complete level of voice because he's like, what is this? And then Savio Vega comes out, they brawl, that's the end of the show. Very random.
It's very random, and it's strange. Like, honestly, he does look a lot like Razor Ramon.
He does. He does. It's very true. He does look very like Razor. But it'll be fascinating. So, overall, your first episode of Monday Night Raw, September 23rd, 1996. We've got a stalker, we've got body Donnas, we've got Jim Ross turning heel, we've got a fake Razor and Diesel. There's a new Intercontinental Champion. Sonny's got a brick in a parse. This was all in a 1 hour show.
Yeah.
I feel like more happened in this than the entire 3 hour Raw this week.
Yeah, no, I really think it did. There was so much, and so much of it is so bonkers. I don't know. I really enjoyed this episode. I thought it was pretty fun. I think it's a good place to start. I mean, it just so happened that it was 20 years ago this week, but it seems like they're kicking off some things. So I don't know. It seems like, you know, we picked a good time to start doing this, I guess. And I definitely enjoyed it. I am curious to see where some of the stories go. It's weird because I know enough to know like where the stories go, but I think there's a big difference in watching it play out versus just knowing what happens. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, you could tell me that Barry Windham was the stalker and I'd be like, well, that sounds ridiculous. But seeing Barry Windham as the stalker was amazing.
I do genuinely want to know why he kept the mustache.
I know. It's a legitimate question.
Baffled. I might just ask Jim Ross and Jim Cornette when they come over. Why did he keep the mustache blonde and he had black face paint?
I want to know all about the stalker.
Lots of questions. So we will be back next week, next Friday, because 20 years ago today, this episode aired on USA Network. And next week we will do the same thing. We'll be back talking about the September 30th episode, where the main event is Shawn Michaels and Jose Lothario against Vader and Jim Cornette. We're also going to find out who the real Double J is and hear his story. Sondra, it is an exciting time.
Oh boy. Oh boy. So much to look forward to.
So we will be back next week on September 30th, 1996, to talk about what's happening. And I hear they're making another Batman movie. Batman and Robin. Schwarzenegger's going to be in it.
I bet it's going to be really, really good.
Comes out next year. George Clooney's going to be Batman. Mm-hmm. Nothing can go wrong there, right? He was in ER.
Yeah.
It's going to be really good. So, Sondra, where can we find you on the social media device that hasn't been made yet?
That thing from the far, far future. Find me at Sondra Ruth RW.
You can find me at KennyMC1985. Find us at Inside_the Ropes. Let us know what you think of the show. Did you enjoy it? Is there something you'd like us to add to it? Any features? We want to know what you thought of the show. And watch these shows along with us, because I know that Mel, one of our loyal listeners, was saying that she's going to watch along with us. Because whether you've watched it before or you haven't watched it at all, I think it'll be fun for us to go through this every week.
I think so too. And I think it does help having seen it as opposed to just, you know, listening about it. And the shows are, you know, they're shorter. At least for the next, 6 months, they're only an hour. Mm-hmm. Which is like 40-some minutes, because they cut all the ads out, obviously. So it's kind of refreshing.
No 3-hour Raws in sight.
No.
Apart from in 20 years' time when we are reviewing the 2016 episodes.
When you're reviewing the 2016 episodes. I still get 2-hour SmackDown.
I love the idea that, like, mid-50s Sondra's still doing a SmackDown summary. So, thank you for listening, everyone. We will be back next week. And if you're listening to this on YouTube, let us know what you think in the comments. And we will be back. Goodbye.
Bye.